So we are on page 5. Page 5. We really just started our study. And if you'll remember, we went over basically the format of our study. It's going to be consisting of about 6 different booklets that we'll prepare on various aspects of apologetics, the study of apologetics. Interesting, I talked with Jerry just this afternoon. He mentioned that when I did a lesson on the subject of apologetics about a year ago, he didn't hear the definition of apologetics. And the term is not a term that you see often. Of course, it is a term from which we get the English word apology. But that's not what's intended by this particular word. The idea is a defense. So it is a defense of our faith. It can be used in general if you are apologizing for any particular thing or engaged in an apologetic defense of something. It can be used in a more generic term, but it is actually a system of study and defense that has been developed to defend the Christian faith. And we're going to be seeking to defend the Christian faith against secular atheism, against philosophies that do not coincide with the Christian faith, against other religions, against modernists who would seek to claim that the Bible is not inspired. Other religions, we're going to talk about alleged discrepancies in the Bible text, talk about how we got the Bible, things that will, I think, if we're open-minded and if we're diligent in our study of these things, will actually very much increase our faith, give us even more of a foundation and justification for the belief that we have in God, but also will equip us to answer skeptics if we come across them from time to time, and to be able to answer the call to give an answer, answer the call to give an answer for the hope of life within us with meekness and with fear. And so that's basically the purpose of the material. And what we did last week is just begin with the definition of that term, as we have related again, and then talked about, we talked about the text in Hebrews chapter 11, verses 1 through 3 of the text, that faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Verse 3 of the text, by faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God, so that things which are seen were not made of things which are visible. And we indicated from that this text is not a definition of the term faith. But it does describe faith, or certain characteristics or attributes of faith. When you look at the statement made, especially in verse 3, that by faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the Word of God, we recognize the worlds are those things that are seen, but God, as deity, as the supernatural first cause, is someone, a being, that we cannot see. And cannot see unless God reveals Himself to us, and so we are at His. We have to accept the means by which God has revealed Himself to us, the evidence that God has supplied to establish for us our faith. These are parameters that God has set forth, as indicated here by the text. And as such, there are many individuals in the world today that, because they cannot see God, refuse to believe that God is the creator of the universe. And so we have to reason with them, and that's what we attempt to do. The first point that we wanted to make in our study is that though we are people of faith, that it is wrong to characterize us as people of blind faith. In other words, though we acknowledge the fact that we cannot see God, that empirically we cannot prove His existence, that does not mean that His existence is not plausible, that He does not in reality exist, and that there is not sufficient evidence to prove to the individual who is of an open mind the reasonable thesis that is ours, that God exists and He created all things. Let me just kind of give you a parallel in this regard. We have a very stringent requirement in jurisprudence in America that an individual is to be considered innocent until he is proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And when you look at that, the burden of proof is upon the prosecutor to prove that an individual is guilty. And all that a defense attorney need do is to give some plausible defense for his client in order to get him off from whatever accusation is raised. And so, with regard to this, let's say that an individual is accused of murder. And you have the scenario with eyewitnesses or DNA evidence or all these kinds of things. And the defense tries to throw another theory out. In order for that defense to be acceptable, that theory that is thrown out there must be plausible. So a defense attorney cannot say, we postulate that an alien came down and zapped him with a ray gun, and that's how he died. You know, that's not a plausible thing. It's not something that would insert into a reasonable mind, an intelligent person, reasonable doubt. So what we're talking about here is the examination of the evidence. We're going to seek to supply that evidence from various areas, which will allow an individual who has an open mind and who has the ability, the intelligence to reason, to recognize that explanation is the right one. That explanation is the true one, that God exists, that He is the creator of the universe, that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, that the Bible is the inspired Word of God, that heaven and hell exists, and all of the other things that we're going to be postulating as we go through this material and the substance of it. So we want to emphasize the fact that our faith, we accept that it is by faith that we accept God's existence. We proclaim that it is by faith that we accept God's existence, but we deny that existence, or that faith, is an unreasonable faith. We believe it to be reasonable, and that there is sufficient evidence to make that the right and the plausible and the correct explanation of the origin of all things, the existence of all things. So, having said that, we had a passage of Scripture that we alluded to from the 19th Psalm. We read Romans chapter 1 that establishes what we refer to as the teleological argument. And it's just one. It's kind of a test case that I'm kind of throwing out there to introduce our study. It's actually not the purpose of this particular section, but I did want to kind of get into it quickly. And I actually gave you a couple of quotes just at the end of the time that we had last week, and I want to bring that back and talk a little bit more about that. But I would like you to read with me from the 19th Psalm, Psalm 19, verses 1 through 4. Psalm 19, verses 1 through 4. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows His handiwork. Day unto day utters speech, and night unto night reveals knowledge. There is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. Their line has gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. So what this is basically stating, of course, if you want a technical definition of the teleological argument, we're going to go elsewhere. We'll spend some time doing that. But this is the sacred designation or telling of the teleological argument. And that basically is that God's creation testifies as to the existence of God Himself. When you look at the heavens, when you look at the firmament, what you see is handiwork. You see something that has design. There's actually a term that is used with regard to the universe that's very, very common. Carl Sagan had a TV show that had that as its title, Cosmos. The term cosmos, if you look at the definition of that term, is an ordered universe. The concept of cosmos is in contrast to the concept of chaos. So when you think about those terms, kind of think of them as opposites, cosmos and chaos. And what we have in the universe is order. It is very obvious that that order exists, whether it be at the molecular level or if it be at the level of largest scale concerning the solar system and concerning the galaxies and concerning the universe itself, that there is order that exists. And the argument is a simple one, that where there is order, there is one who ordered it. Of necessity, that is the case. There are many who deny that where order exists, there of necessity must be an orderer. Where design exists, there must be a designer. But that is the argument that we make. And we'll talk about this in more detail as we get into our discussion of evidences later on in our studies. But I did want to point out two things. Number one, I wanted to point out that there are many individuals who have either a philosophical or a scientific background. They have those strings of letters after their name to indicate that they have given themselves over to such disciplines. And they have learned and mastered those materials. Not saying the majority by any means, but that there are some who hold the position that there must of necessity be a designer as a result of the design that we see in the universe. And that is a reasonable assumption that we can make. And this is just one argument of many that we'll use. Looking at the two quotes that we read last time, I want to just touch upon them very quickly and give opportunity for individuals to comment on them. And then I'm going to actually show you another couple of quotes where we examine that argument. And by the way, I want to use this somewhat as a test with regard to this class. This is the first time that I've really taken this approach in teaching a Bible class. And I'm not exactly sure, number one, how well I'll explain it and how easily everyone will understand it. And so in order for me to know exactly how in-depth we're going to go and what we're going to talk about, I'm going to kind of use this as a test and see if we can grasp the concepts together we're going to be talking about so that I'll know how to go on for the future in this regard. So if I'm not explaining myself clearly, or there's something that you're not understanding, if you will, let me know. You don't have to raise your hand in class like, if you don't want to. Believe me, if you don't know, then you're my fault, not yours. So don't feel bad about that. But if you will, talk to me afterwards and let me know that you were struggling with some aspect of it. But I want to make sure that I'm clear about these things, but I don't want to get so in-depth that for a lot of you it becomes like pulling teeth as we try to go through these things. So that's my intent with regard to the argument we're going to make in just a few moments. But first of all, a quote from Fred Hoyle. As you'll know, Fred Hoyle, as we mentioned last time, is a noted British astronomer. He passed away in the year 2001. He was an instructor at the Cambridge Institute of Astronomy, and he formulated some very highfalutin theories concerning stellar nucleosynthesis. So he's a well-respected, well-known scientist. And he says, concerning this teleological argument, would you not say to yourself, some super calculating intellect must have designed the properties of the carbon atom? Otherwise, the chance of finding such an atom through the blind forces of nature would be utterly minuscule. This is just one example that he's given. The construct of the carbon atom, he indicates, is of such a nature that the idea of blind forces bringing it about, that one thing, that one atom, is something that would be utterly minuscule. A common sense interpretation of the facts suggests that a super intellect has monkeyed with physics. That is, in other words, he's involved himself in these things, as well as with chemistry and biology, and that there are no blind forces worth speaking about in nature. The numbers one calculates from the facts seem to me to be so overwhelming as to put this conclusion almost beyond question. Now, just to enlarge upon this so that you'll understand what he's saying, there are so many examples like the carbon atom that indicate the design. Again, we said that we could give you examples of this structure that exists on a molecular level all the way up to the most macro or large scale order that you can consider, both with regard to minerals, with regard to biology, with regard to chemistry, all of these areas. And when you have all of those examples added together, the idea or the concept that all of those examples together could have come into being as they are and as they exist today by blind chance or by blind forces, that's something that is implausible. That's an unreasonable explanation and an unreasonable decision or conclusion that we might draw in that regard. So that's what Fred Hoyle had to say on that particular matter. So he believed that there is a super intellect. Now, by the way, with regard to these individuals, we're not going to say that these individuals that we're quoting, especially when we're saying, hey, look here, there are scientists who believe that there is a God, that they are Christians, or that they believe in the God of the Bible. That's not the point here. And just because Fred Hoyle said it, that doesn't mean that it's so. In other words, there is no more validity and authority in what Fred Hoyle says than what Carl Sagan said, or what Richard Dawkins says, or Stephen Hawking, or anyone else who is an atheistic evolutionist. But what it does indicate is that the claims that are being made today, that in order for you to be a Christian and to believe in the existence of God, you must be superstitious and ignorant, which is commonly proclaimed, is absolutely not so. There are many individuals, even who have training in these disciplines, who believe in the existence of God. The other example that we'll give is a philosopher by the name of Antony Flew. He's an English philosopher and a one-time avowed atheist. He, in fact, signed the Human Manifesto in the year 2003. The Humanist Manifesto is kind of the constitution of the atheist with regard to humanistic values. But he changed his view, and he made known his change in view in the year 2004. And as I mentioned last week, in 2006, he joined 11 other academics in urging the British government to teach intelligent design in the public schools of Great Britain. So he did a complete turnaround. And he, again, did so because of the teleological argument. He said, an intelligent being is involved in some way in the design of conditions. He postulated an intelligent being as involved in some way in the design of conditions that would allow life to arise and evolve. You'll hear terms like teleological arguments, fine-tuning of the universe. We're going to talk about that in a moment. And the anthropic principle. The anthropic principle is that there is evidence to suggest in the way in which the universe exists that it exists and was designed in such a way as to support life. And so the anthropic principle is what's under consideration here in his. There must be a design present so that life could exist and that life could arise and evolve. So he concluded that the fine-tuning of the universe was too precise to be the result of chance and accepted the existence of God. He always proclaimed his commitment to go where the evidence leads, and so at the end of his life, it meant that he ended up accepting the existence of God. And in fact, you'll notice there that he was basically advocating what Fred Hoyle had advocated before him. So these are two examples. And basically, what I'm trying to establish here is that the way that it is often proclaimed that it's us against them, and that there is this monolithic, and unassailable wall of science, everyone in complete and total accord, that the creation account, that the concept of the existence of God, that these things are absurd and ridiculous, is not so. And that there are reasonable individuals, intelligent individuals, in fact, brilliant individuals who are trained in these disciplines who believe there to be a divine being. And the reason, again, that it's found in this particular point is because this point in our outline, the first bullet point, is that our faith is not an unreasonable faith. That reasonable individuals can hold to the existence of God. Okay, so there is an argument that an individual... First of all, I want to define that term fine-tuned. And this is where I'm going to get into some things that some of you might find a little bit difficult. So, again, if there's anything that's problematic, please raise your hand. The phrase that was used by Anthony Flew, he concluded that the fine-tuning of the universe was too precise to be the result of chance. That is actually what they refer to as an offshoot of the teleological argument, the argument concerning fine-tuning or a fine-tuned universe. And so what does that mean as these philosophers and these scientists use this concept? Well, there is a definition that I gave or a description of that from a website called Biologos. And there's a quote that I'll give you in just a few moments as well. Fine-tuning refers to the surprising precision of nature's physical constants and the precision of the beginning state of the universe. Both of these features converge as potential pointers to a creator. This is the argument. To explain the present state of the universe, scientific theories require that the physical constants of nature, like the strength of gravity and also that the beginning state of the universe, like its density, has a physical and a very precise constant. These values have to be there in precisely the area that they're there in order for the theories that these secularists are coming up with, for them to work. There has to be these constants. And these constants are so precise, the slightest variation from their values results in an early universe that never becomes capable of hosting life. For this reason, the universe seems to be finely tuned for life. In other words, if it wasn't exactly the way it is, then life could not exist. It would have all fallen apart. And life, as we know it, would never have come about. The fine-tuned universe is an intelligence design argument. I'm not saying that scientists are arguing this. I'm saying that scientists are saying that the universe has to be exactly the way it is, or else life couldn't have come about. And we argue that since it has to be exactly the way it is, that is an indication that it was designed in that particular way by a supreme being. Yes, Justin?
But it says there, in the beginning state of the universe, like its density. What does it even mean in saying that? What does it mean by the beginning state of the universe?
The idea here is, again, taking from the argumentation of the secular scientists, that what had to happen for the Big Bang to occur, that the circumstances, the situation, had to be exactly such for a stable universe to come out of the Big Bang, or as a product of the Big Bang.
So that's what I thought. So they're arguing the beginning state of the universe, meaning the millionth of a second after the Big Bang, had to be very precise in order for all these other precisions to maintain truth, and that points towards design.
Yeah.
But that's not a design we agree with.
No, it's not. But that's not the point that we're making here. Because our construct would be, in the beginning God said, let there be light, there was light. In the beginning God created heaven and earth. That's what we believe. But the point is, their view is, and that this is that the universe as it exists today, and again, it's the constants of the universe in addition to the beginning or the origin of the universe, that these things are such, and they have to be such, precisely this way, in order for life to be possible. And as such, scientists who accept the concept of the Big Bang and accept the concept of evolution. In fact, we read just a few moments ago from Anthony Flew when he talked about the universe too precise to be the result of chance, and that these conditions had to be in place so that life would arise and evolve. So he's still an evolutionist. I'm not saying that Anthony Flew is not an evolutionist. He's just simply saying there must have been someone behind it, because the way the universe is as it is today is a fine-tuned universe that necessitates the idea of a designer or a tuner behind it.
So here's what I worry about. I worry about talking to very many people in terms like these, because seems like you're setting yourself up for a very confusing argument on both sides of the equation. And I don't know who sitting here right now in this room could explain to me why gravity being slightly stronger or slightly less strong would mean life couldn't exist. I don't know that anyone in this room could explain that to me right now.
I certainly could.
And so,
except if it was too much, unless we would float off here. Other than that,
later I'll explain why it's not true. But the point is that you've got all these scientists that go and they say things and then are later disproved, right? And a lot of people, if you start any kind of science thing like that, they'll kick off on one of those things. And even people that believe in the Bible, they'll use the reverse arguments to do that, right? Somebody carbon dated some penguin and it showed up to be X number of years, and then later it was proved, it wasn't millions of years, it was only 5,000 years or something like that. Or someone carbon dates a strata of Earth and they say, it's this many million years old. And then they find a human skull and they're like, wait a minute. And then they go back, we did something wrong, it's really this many years old. And so a lot of these arguments, either you're going to get somebody where it's just, it's not profitable for them to think about it because it's so macro that the brain doesn't even want to think about it. Or you get somebody that begins to dig into it a little bit and they're like, well, how do you even know that's true? How do you know science isn't going to disprove that? Or how do you even know we can't know enough variables to know whether or not that's true? Or you get a whole actually thinks he knows something, and then you get off into weeds that you never want to get into.
No, okay, so let me then restate my purpose in bringing this up. I'm not suggesting anyone use these arguments to individuals who are scientists or who are atheists. Again, the purpose of the study is twofold. It's to strengthen our faith and also to be able to answer the individuals. If I'm going to use the teleological argument, I'm going to quote Psalm 19. I'm not going to go to this kind of stuff. Let me explain why. Because I'm not a scientist. I am I'm a preacher. So I'm much more familiar with what the text indicates. I'm going to quote Romans chapter 1. I'm going to look at other things. I think the teleological argument is a legitimate one that we can utilize. I'm not saying that it'll always convince someone, but I do think it's a legitimate argument because it's the argument that the Apostle Paul used in Acts 17, Romans chapter 1. And it's also the argument that the psalmist made in Psalm 19. What I'm wanting to do with this particular point is to indicate that there are concessions that are made by scientists with regard to their theories, the theories that they hold with regard to the beginnings of the universe. Scientists make concessions with these things that give credence to the concept of a designer, a divine designer. And it is to indicate to us that when science presents itself, in our modern day, science has become a god to many people, and impregnable. I mean, you see the language here. Language is difficult, first of all, when we look at these things. These are concepts. And I thought that science would give me the biggest headache, but I've been looking at philosophy today, in looking at this. That gives me the biggest headache. I mean, its philosophy is ridiculous. But the philosophical arguments of all, when individuals do this, that there are answers to them, and that just because the concepts are difficult and the vocabulary is challenging and the way of thinking is something that is foreign to us, is no reason for us to doubt the legitimacy of our faith. And what I'm trying to give you is a taste of the fact that when these kinds of things come up, and you'll hear them and they'll throw those things at you, that there are others in that same community that take that same data and they say that it points to the concept of deity. And again, if you will just go along with me with regard to this one night and this first point that I'm going to make with regard to the fine-tuning of the universe, so you can see what I'm talking about. And then from that point in time, we're going to be getting into archaeology and other kinds of things. It'll be a lot easier to do. Now, I am going to revisit the teleological argument later on, but I just want to use this as an example. Yes, Dan?
As you brought on these quotes from these men and in Psalm 19 and the cosmos and what we have here in Romans 1 and especially verse 20, that men are without excuse of all that we do see, that quotes and all in the scriptures, and from that they can know of God, but as you probably touch on later on, as we know that we cannot know God except for His holy scriptures, as Galatians 4:8 brings out, says, but then indeed when you did not know God, you served those which by nature are not gods, I should say, verse 9. But now, after you have known God, or rather are known by God, how it is that you turn, then it goes another thing there. But this knowing God and being known by God is a spiritual intimacy.
Well, that's a very, very valid point, which we'll, I'm sure, have opportunity in later lessons to delve into more deeply. Science. Let me rephrase that. Nature, with regard to even the declarations indicated in Psalm 19, is very limited in that it has no facility, no ability to tell us anything about what God is like, who He is, what His will for us is. It can only testify as to His existence. And when you see those arguments from nature, it is always that of an omnipotent God who has the ability to create. In order for us to know God, we have to... No man can know the mind of God unless God reveals it to him. So we have to find what the mind of God is, if He has indeed revealed it to us. And, of course, our contention is He has the Scripture. Okay, so let's...
To be known by God, we have to do His will. We know God, but not we don't do His will, we won't be known by Him.
Well, that's true.
Right.
You're talking about a relationship there. Yeah.
But as far, then I'll comment about the Big Bang Theory. My understanding is that those scientists, or whatever you want to call them, that do not believe in God, they do not accept the Big Bang Theory, because then that demands to have a creator or an eternal being there for the beginning. So a lot of those that... They won't accept the Big Bang Theory because of that. Because it's the beginning, you know.
Well, no, I don't think that's accurate, Dick.
Put
it this way, that there are individuals who are scientists.
I didn't make that up. I mean, I've read
no,
that.
No, no, there are individuals who are scientists that claim that the very concept of the Big Bang Theory requires a God.
Right.
And that's there are others who deny it.
That's why they reject it. Those that don't reject the bang theory because of that.
Yeah, but again, when it comes to the scientific community, it's almost universal that they have accepted the Big Bang Theory. I mean, it's reached that point. In fact, it's to the point where many say it's proven. There are some who claim that it's proven. But again, with regard to that, I want to get to this next point. This is an argument that was raised by this is the philosophy. This is kind of interesting, actually. But George Schlesinger, professor of philosophy at the University of North Carolina, That's where the Tar Heels play basketball. So it's a major university and very well-respected individual. And he argued from this fine-tuning argument. The universe is fine-tuned. And he gave a statistical illustration to argue his point. It's a very simple one, relatively simple one. And that is, if John wins a 1 in 1 billion lottery game, you would not immediately be tempted to think that John or someone acting on his behalf cheated. It's not, it can happen. Or somebody's going to win, so it could happen. 1 in 1 billion. But if John won 3 consecutive 1 in 1,000 lotteries, you would immediately be tempted to think that John or someone acting on his behalf cheated. And so this is the position or an argument that Schlesinger used. He believes the intuitive reaction of these two scenarios is epistemically justified. Okay, so this is it. The structure of the latter event, that is the 3 1 in 1,000 lotteries won, is such that it justifies a belief that intelligent design is the cause. In other words, it was a random blind chance, but someone rigged the lotteries for that person to win because he won 3 in a row. And that's an intuitive conclusion to come to. Despite the fact the probability of winning 3 consecutive 1 in 1,000 games is exactly the same as the probability of winning 1 in a billion game. But the 1 in 1,000, 3 consecutive wins, warrants the idea that there was some shenanigans going on. Okay, so this is the point that he's making. That it's not just the carbon atom. It's not just the structure of the eyeball. It's not just the Earth being the exact right distance away from the sun. It's not just the moon being the exact right distance away from the Earth. It's not just these things. It's not just chemistry. It's not just biology. It's not just mineralogy. It's all of these things together that when you take all of these structural, fine-tuned realities that seem to indicate design, all of them together makes the view that it happened merely by blind forces as being implausible. And the more plausible explanation is as that they came about as a result of design. In fact, I would assert, the assertion that I would make is that it's the only plausible explanation. I knew this was going to take too long. So, I promise that we'll get into the rest of the stuff next week. This is another man. His name is Kenneth Hema, who didn't like what Schlesinger had to say. Kenneth Hema is he's also a philosopher. I thought that I had where he was from, but he wrote Design Arguments for the Existence of God. He's in Phoenix, Arizona. I remember looking at that and finding, because I wanted to get all these down as to who these people are, so that they're at least there for the purpose of anyone who wants to look into it. I'll have to add that later. And he also is a college professor of philosophy, and he wrote in the Internet Encyclopedia of Philosophy on April 12, 2009, the following quote: "The mere fact that it is enormously improbable that an event occurred by itself gives us no reason to think that it occurred by design, as intuitively tempting as it may be." So his argument is, just because it's very improbable doesn't necessarily mean that it was designed and that we cannot infer that. He's advocating that Schlesinger's and these other people who are saying that's so mathematically improbable it had to be a designer, that's not so. That the only way that we can infer such a thing is if two things are present. Now, going back to the lottery, the only way we can infer that there were shenanigans going on is if we knew of outside agencies that could involve themselves in the lottery and rig things. And the other thing that we would have to know is that in times past, past experience indicates that when these improbable things happen, it is as a result of such shenanigans. And with those two things, if that knowledge isn't there, then we could not infer that it was. Hanky panky that led to those wins. And so he says the teleological argument that he's making is not valid. And I want you to think about that for just a moment. And the idea is, and again, just to note very quickly, that phrase there is intuitively tempting as it may be. I want you to think about that moment. Again, these are arguments. Arguments are not proof. Arguments are constructs in order to interpret the proof, interpret the data that is out there. Now, what he is accepting as a philosopher is that it is intuitively tempting to believe in the concept of the designer. Why is it intuitively tempting? Because that's the most plausible scenario, isn't it? Now, I recognize the limitations of the argumentation. What atheists are basically saying is because we do not have that empirical evidence of a divine creator, then we have to reject what is the most plausible explanation for the universe. And you'll find this kind of argument. I think this is a consequence of the scientific thought that is so prevalent in our society today. That is, we have to explain everything by the natural. The supernatural can't come into it. So, was Jesus resurrected from the dead? No, he was not. How do we know he was not? Because bodies don't raise from the dead. That's unnatural. You ask the question with regard to miracles. Were miracles performed in the first century? Absolutely not. Why? Because there is no natural means of explaining the phenomena. You have to go beyond sprint. With this one out. With regard to teaching intelligent design in the schools, why do individuals who say that we should not teach intelligent design in the schools say that? Because it's religion, not science. Now, when you think about it for a moment, we can't teach religion in the schools. What if it's actually true? Now think about that more. We can't do it. We have to come up with a naturalistic explanation for why everything is what it is, because supernatural is religion, and we can't have religion in the schools. Well, if supernatural is the actual truth, then what it means is we can't teach the truth in the schools. We have to teach something that's not the truth. So this is the question. Is it valid or not? Whether it's valid or not is what matters. Not that, well, it's plausible, but it can't be that. We've got to reject that. And as such, we come up with the next scenario. And that's what scientists, in fact, are doing. It is intuitively tempting. This philosopher says that. It's the most plausible. And so what they're doing is rejecting the most plausible for another explanation that is less plausible. You talk to it. I can give you a number of quotes that will say this basic same thing. That scientists have problems with various aspects of the theory of evolution. And one, I forget exactly which scientist it was, I'll try to have it for next week, but he basically said this: yes, there are problems with the theory of evolution, but it's all we've got. And the other is unthinkable. The other that's unthinkable is supernatural. And so there is a bias that exists. And so I'll make this my final point. We did our green class, right?
Okay.
This is my final point. We are biased. We believe in the supernatural. We believe in the divine God of heaven. We accept and admit our bias. The atheist, the evolutionist, they are biased as well. They are unwilling to accept the plausibility of the supernatural. Therefore, they are wed to the concept of a natural explanation of all things. Their bias is every bit as extant and as structured and as impregnable as our own bias with regard to the belief in God. And so all it comes down to then is what is the most plausible explanation of the data? What is the most plausible explanation of the proof that is out there? Is it a natural explanation for the origin of all things, origin of life, the existence of the universe as it is today, or is it a supernatural explanation of those things? And that's what we're going to be seeking today. So, the point is, it took me 2 weeks to get here, but our faith is a reasonable faith. Being a reasonable faith doesn't make it so, but we have evidence that we're going to supply to show that it is so. and that there is reason behind our contentions that it is so. So if I confuse everybody, let me know. We're going on anyway, and I'll get away from it for a while. But I wanted the philosophy of this to kind of come out a little bit in our discussion this evening. Thank you very much for your kind attention.